This is Audible.
Op Center, Mirror Image. Created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachenik. Written by Jeff Roven. Read by Michael Kramer. Prologue. Friday, 5:50 p.m., St. Petersburg.
Pavel, said Pyotr Volodya.
I don't understand.
Pavel Adinya squeezed the steering wheel tightly. He looked unpleasantly at the man sitting next to him in the passenger seat of the van.
You don't understand what, Pyotr?
You forgive the French, Pyotr
replied, scratching a woolly sideburn.
So why not the Germans? Both of them have invaded Mother Russia.
Pavel frowned.
If you can't see the difference, Pyotr, you're a fool.
That's not an answer,
said Ivan, one of the four men seated in the back.
It happens to be true,
grinned Eduard, who was seated beside him.
But Ivan is right. It isn't an answer.
Pavel shifted gears. This was the part of the nightly half-hour commute, the Nepokorenich Prospekt apartments, that he hated most. Just 2 minutes out from the Hermitage, they had to slow as they neared the bottleneck at the Neva River. They were mired in traffic while his political nemesis were proceeding at full speed. Pavel pulled a nearly rolled cigarette from his shirt pocket, and Pyotr lit it for him.
Thanks, Pyotr.
You still haven't answered me, Pyotr said.
I will, Pavel insisted, when we've gotten onto the bridge. I can't think and curse at the same time.
Pavel swung the van suddenly from the center lane to the left lane, jolting the men to the other side. Having fallen asleep when they left the Hermitage, both Oleg and Konstantin awoke with a jolt.
You're too impatient, Pavel, Ivan said. What are you in such a rush to get home to, your wife? Since when?
Very funny, Pavel said.
The truth was, he wasn't hurrying to get to anything. He was in a rush to get away from the pressure, away from the deadline that had consumed them for months on end. Now that it was nearly over, he couldn't wait to go back to designing computer animation software for Mosfilm. Shifting gears again, Pavel zigzagged between the rows of small Zaporozhets 968s with their sputtering 43-horsepower engines and the larger five-seat Volga M124s. There was also a smattering of foreign cars, though only government officials and black marketeers drove them. No one else could afford to. He and his comrades wouldn't even be driving this van if the TV studio hadn't provided it. The powerful Swiss-made vehicle was the only thing he would miss.
No, that isn't true, he thought as he glanced west.
He savored the sight of the Peter and Paul fortress on the opposite banks of the Neva, as the setting sun glinted off its tall, graceful spires. He would also miss St. Petersburg. He would miss the beauty of these blazing orange sunsets on the Gulf of Finland, the calming flow of the blue waters of the Neva, the Fontanka, and the Ekaterinburgsky rivers, and the simple splendor of the many canals. Though the waters were still somewhat dirty from years of communist neglect, they were no longer thick with foul-smelling industrial waste as they wound through the heart of the ancient city, Russia's Venice. He would miss the majesty of the ruby-red Belozersky Palace, the gilt interiors of the Alexander Nevsky Chapel, where he sometimes went to pray, the towering golden onion domes of Catherine the Great's palace, and the peaceful gardens and cascading fountains of Peter the Great's palace, Petrodvorets. He would miss the sleek white hydrofoils that skimmed along the Neva, looking like something from a science fiction novel by Stanislaw Lem. And he would miss the magnificent battleships that dwarfed them, coming and going to the Nakhimov Naval School on Aptekarsky Island in the Neva. And, of course, he would miss the incomparable Hermitage. Though they weren't supposed to wander in the museum, he always took time to do just that when Colonel Roski was occupied. Even if someone did see him day after day, he was supposed to be an employee there. No one would give it a thought. Besides, a religious man can't be put among the likes of Rembrandt's Descent from the Cross, or Carracci's Lamentation of Christ, or his favorite, the school of Ribalta's St. Vincent in a Dungeon, and not be expected to look. Especially when he felt such a kinship to the trapped but resolute St. Vincent. But he would be happy to get away from the work itself, from the stress and the 7-day work weeks, and especially the watchful eyes of Colonel Roski. He had served under the bastard in Afghanistan, and cursed the fate that had brought them back together for the past 18 months. As he always did when he reached the bridge of the Kirovsky Prospekt, Pavel made his way to the outside lane with its low concrete barricade and more intrepid motorists. He breathed easier as he settled in among the faster-moving vehicles.
"You want an answer?" Pavel asked, drawing hard on his cigarette.
"To which question?"
Ivan joked.
"The one about your wife?"
Pavel scowled.
"I'll tell you the difference between the Germans and the French. The French followed Napoleon because they were hungry. They've always put comfort before decency."
"What about the resistance?" Piotr asked.
"A freak, a reflexive twitch of the corpse. If the resistance in France had been as strong as the Russian resistance in Stalingrad, Paris would never have fallen."
Pavel applied pressure to the pedal to keep a Volkswagen from cutting right and getting in front of him. Black marketeer, he guessed from the surly look of the woman. Pavel glanced in the mirror as a truck pulled behind him from the center lane.
"The French are not evil," Pavel continued. "But the Germans followed Hitler because they're still vandals at heart. Give them time. Their factories will once again be turning out tanks and bombers, I guarantee it."
Piotr shook his head.
"What about Japan?" "Also bastards," said Pavel. "If Dugin wins the election, he'll watch them too."
"And is paranoia a sensible reason to vote for any man for president?"
"It's not paranoia to fear old enemies, it's caution." "It's provocation," Piotr said. "You don't get behind a man because he's vowed to strike the Germans at the first sign of remilitarization."
"That was only one reason."
The road ahead cleared, and Pavel sped up as he crossed the wide, dark river. The men shut the windows against the sharp wind.
"Dugin promised to revitalize the space program, which will strengthen the economy. He'll build more studios like ours, and constructing new factories along the Trans-Siberian Railroad will provide cheap goods and new housing."
"And where will the money come from to achieve these wonders?" Piotr asked.
"Our little nest back there cost 25 billion rubles. Do you really believe if Dugin wins, he can cut enough fat from the government and from foreign adventures?"
Pavel blew out smoke and nodded. Piotr frowned. He cocked a thumb over his shoulder.
"That isn't what I overheard back there. Number two was talking to an aide about the thieves-in-law. That's where he plans to get the money. And it's a dangerous association to—"
Pavel reacted instinctively as the Volkswagen suddenly angled in front of him. He pushed down hard on the brake and spun the wheel to the right. As he did so, he heard a pop, and thick green smoke began pouring from under the dashboard.
"What is it?"
Piotr coughed.
"Open a window!"
one of the men yelled from the back as they all began to gag. But Pavel had already fallen against the wheel, barely conscious. There was no one steering as the truck struck them from behind. The Volkswagen was partly in the right lane as the truck drove the van into it. The left side of the van's front fender struck the car, skidding and sparking along its right side. Pointed toward the side of the bridge, the van hit the low concrete barrier and rode up and over, propelled by the truck. The right tire exploded, the axle hooked over the top of the barricade, and the van plunged nose first into the choppy river. There was a hiss as it struck the water, the van standing upright for a long moment before falling over on its back. Steam and air bubbles rose from the sides, mixing with the dissipating green smoke as the van bobbed belly up on the surface of the river. The rest of the van was entirely submerged. The burly truck driver and the young blonde woman who had been driving the Volkswagen were the first ones to reach the shattered railing. They were joined by other motorists who scurried from their cars. Neither the man nor the woman said a word to each other. They just watched as the van drifted to the southwest, twisting slowly in the current, the air bubbles dwindling and the smoke now just a faint wisp. The vehicle was already too far away for anyone to dive in and attempt to look for survivors. The two drivers assured those who asked that they were all right. Then they made their way back to their vehicles to await the police. No one had seen the truck driver drop a small rectangular box in the river as he turned away. Chapter 1. Saturday, 10 a.m. Moscow. Tall, powerfully built Minister of the Interior, Nikolai Dugin, sat behind the centuries-old oak desk in his office in the Kremlin. There was a computer in the center of the heavy, age-toned desk. To his right was a black telephone, and a small framed photograph of his parents sat on his left. The snapshot had a horizontal crease in the center. It had been folded by his father so he could carry it in his shirt pocket during the war. Dugin's silver-gray hair was brushed straight back. His cheeks were sunken, and his dark eyes looked tired. His plain brown GUM department store suit was wrinkled, and his light brown shoes were scuffed, a careful, studied rumpledness that had worked so well for so many years. But not this week, he thought bitterly. For the first time in 30 years of public service, his man-of-the-people image had failed him. With his characteristic intensity, he had given his people the nationalism they had said they wanted. He voiced renewed pride in the military and fanned suspicion of old enemies. Yet the people had turned on him. Dugin knew why, of course. His rival, Kirill Zhanin, had cast out a tattered net one last glorious time to try and snare the flounder of old Peter's fairy tale, the fish of the sea that would make every wish come true. Capitalism. While Dugin waited for his assistant, he looked past the 7 men seated before him. His dark eyes were focused on the walls, on a history of the success of totalitarianism. Like his desk, the walls reeked of history. They were covered with ornately framed maps, some of them centuries old, maps of Russia under different czars going back to the reign of Ivan. Dugin's tired eyes took them all in, from a faded vellum map painted, it was said, with the blood of captured Teutonic knights, to a cloth map of the Kremlin which had been sewn inside the pant leg of a murdered German assassin. The world as it was, he thought, as his eyes settled upon a map of the Soviet Union that German S. Titov had carried into space in 1961. The world as it will be again. The 7 men sitting on sofas and armchairs were also drawn with age. Most of them were 50 or older, some of them were over 60. Most wore suits, some had on uniforms. None spoke. The silence was broken only by the hum of the fan in the back of the computer, and then, finally, by a knock on the door. "Come in." Dugin felt his heart sink as the door opened and a fresh-faced young man stepped in. There was a profound sadness in the youth's eyes, and Dugin knew what that meant. "Well," Dugin demanded. "I'm sorry," the young man said softly, "but it's official. I reviewed the figures myself." Dugin nodded.
"Thank you.
Shall I make the arrangements?" Dugin nodded again, and the young man backed from the office. He shut the door quietly as he left. Now Dugin looked at the men. Like him, their expressions hadn't changed.
"This was not unexpected," said the Minister of the Interior.
He moved the photograph of his parents closer, running the back of his fingers down the glass. He seemed to be speaking to them.
"Foreign Minister Zhanin has won the election. It's the time, you know. Everyone's giddy with liberty. But it's liberty without responsibility. Freedom without sanity. Experimentation without caution. Russia has elected a president who wants to create a new currency, make our economy a slave to what we can sell abroad, eliminate the black market by making the rubles and goods it holds utterly worthless, eliminate political rivals by making it impossible to oust him lest it upset foreign markets, eliminate the military as an adversary by paying the generals more money to serve his policies than to protect Mother Russia. Like Germany and Japan, he tells us, an economically strong Russia needs fear no enemy."
Dugin's eyes narrowed as he looked at his father's image.
"For 70 years we feared no enemy. Your hero Stalin did not rule Russia. He ruled the world. His name itself came from Stalia, steel. Our people were made of it then, and they responded to power. Today, they seek comfort and respond to audacity and empty promises."
"Welcome to democracy, my dear Nikolai," said General Viktor Mavik, a barrel-chested man with a booming voice. "Welcome to a world in which NATO courts the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, nations of the former Warsaw Pact, to join the Western Alliance without so much as consulting us."
Deputy Finance Minister Yevgeny Grovlev leaned forward, his sharp chin resting on his thumbs, his slender fingers steepled under his hooked nose.
"We must be careful not to overreact," he said. "Zhanyin's reforms won't happen fast enough. The people will turn on him faster than they did on Gorbachev and Yeltsin."
"My adversary is young but not stupid," Dugin replied. "He wouldn't have made promises without agreements being in place. And when he pulls them off, the Germans and Japanese will have what they failed to obtain in World War II. The United States will own what it failed to get during the Cold War. In one way or another, they will all possess Mother Russia."
Dugin turned his eyes to one more map, the map of Russia and Eastern Europe on his computer screen. He pressed a key, and Eastern Europe grew larger. Russia vanished.
"A keystroke of history and we're gone," he said.
"Only by our inactivity," said Lanky Grovliev.
"Yes," Dugin agreed. "By our inactivity."
The room was growing stuffy, and he dabbed the moisture on his upper lip with a tissue.
"The people have thrown off their mistrust of foreigners for the promise of wealth. But we'll show them that isn't the way."
He looked out at the men in the room.
"The fact that you or your candidates lost the election shows how confused our people have become. But the fact that you are here this morning indicates that you want to do something about it."
"We do,"
General Mavik said, running a finger inside his collar.
"And we trust your abilities. You are a strong mayor in Moscow and a loyal communist in the Politburo. But in our first meeting you told us very little of what you planned if the old guard failed to retake the Kremlin."
"Well, the old guard has failed. Now I would like some details."
"So would I,"
said Air Force General Daka. His gray eyes glared from beneath a heavy brow.
"Any one of us would make a formidable opposition leader. Why should we back you? You promised us a cooperative action with Ukraine. So far we've only seen a few Russian infantry maneuvers near the border, which Zhanyin himself quickly approved. Even if joint maneuvers take place, what does that accomplish? Old Soviet brothers are reunited, and the West trembles a little. How will that help us to rebuild Russia? If we're to join you, we must have specifics."
Dugin looked at the general. Daka's full cheeks were flushed, his pendulous chin raw where it met his tightly knotted tie. The minister knew that the specifics would send most of them rallying behind Mavik or even running to Zhanyin. He looked at each of the men in turn. In most faces he saw conviction and strength, while in others, Mavik and Grovliev in particular, he saw interest but wariness. Their hesitation angered him because he was the only one who offered Russia salvation. Yet he remained calm.
"You want specifics?" Dugin asked.
He typed a command on the computer keyboard, then swung the monitor so it faced the seven men. As the hard disk hummed, the interior minister looked at his father's picture. The elder Dugin had been a decorated soldier during the war, and one of Stalin's most trusted bodyguards afterward. He once told his son that during the war he had learned to carry only one thing with him, the country's flag. Wherever he was, in any circumstance, in any danger, it would always find him a friend or ally. When the disk drive fell silent, Dugin and five men rose at once. Mavik and Grovliev exchanged suspicious looks, then slowly got to their feet. Both men saluted.
"This is how I plan to rebuild Russia," Dugin said.
He came around the desk and pointed to the image that filled the computer monitor, a yellow star, hammer, and sickle on a red field, the old Soviet flag.
"By reminding people of their duty, patriots will not hesitate to do whatever is necessary, whatever the plan, and regardless of the cost."
The men sat down, save for Grovliev.
"We're all patriots," said the finance minister. "And I resent the theatrics. If I'm to put my resources in your hands, I want to know how they'll be used. For a coup? A second revolution? Or don't you trust us with this information, Mr. Minister?"
Dugin looked at Grovliev. He couldn't tell him everything. He couldn't tell him about his plans for the military or his involvement with the Russian mafia. Most Russians thought they were still a provincial peasant people, without a world view. Upon hearing his plans, Grovlev might back down or decide to support Zhanyin. Dugin said,
"Mr. Minister, I don't trust you."
Grovlev stiffened.
"And from your questions," Dugin continued, "it's obvious you don't trust me either. I intend to earn that trust through deeds, and you must do the same. Zhanyin knows who his enemies are, and now he has the power of the presidency. He may offer you a post or an appointment you may be tempted to take, and you might then be required to work against me. For the next 72 hours, I must ask you to be patient."
"Why 72 hours? Asked the young blue-eyed Ministry of Security Assistant Director Skula.
"That's how long it will take for my command center to become operational."
Skula froze. 72 hours? You can't mean St. Petersburg. Dugin nodded once. "You control that?" He nodded again.
Skula exhaled, and the other men looked at him. "My most sincere compliments, Minister. That puts the entire world in your hands."
"Quite literally," Dugin grinned. "Just like General Secretary Stalin."
"Excuse me," said Grovlev. "But once again I'm on the outside looking in. Minister Dugin, what exactly is this thing you control?"
"The St. Petersburg Operations Center," Dugin replied. "The most sophisticated reconnaissance and communications facility in Russia. With it, we can access everything from satellite views of the world to electronic communications. The center also has its own field personnel for surgical strike operations."
Grovlev seemed confused. "Are you talking about the television station at the Hermitage?"
"Yes," Dugin said. "It's a front, Minister Grovlev. Your ministry approved the finances for an operational facade, a working TV studio. But the money for the underground complex came from my department, and the funding continues to come from the Interior Ministry."
Dugin thumbed his chest.
"From me." Grovlev sat back down.
"You've been planning this operation for quite some time."
"For over 2 years," Dugin replied. "We go online Monday night."
"And this center," said Daka, "it's your command post for more than simply spying on Zhanyin during these 72 hours.
"Very much more than spying," said Dugin.
"But you won't tell us what," Grovlev huffed. "You want our cooperation, but you won't cooperate."
Dugin said ominously, "You want me to confide in you, Mr. Minister? Fair enough. For the past 6 months, my man in the operations center has been using personnel as well as the electronics that were already installed to watch all of my potential allies as well as my rivals. We've collected a great deal of information about graft, liaisons, and," he glared at Grovlev, "unusual personal interests. I'll be happy to share this information with you collectively or individually, now or later." Some of the men moved uneasily in their chairs. Grovlev sat rock still.
"You bastard," Grovlev growled.
"Yes," said Dugin, "I am that. A bastard who will get the job done." The Interior Minister looked at his watch, then walked over to Grovlev and stared down into his narrow eyes. "I must leave now, Minister. I have a meeting with the new president. There are congratulations to tender, some papers for him to sign. But within 12 hours, you'll be able to judge for yourself whether I am working for vanity or," he pointed to the flag on the monitor, "for this." With a nod to the silent assembly, Minister Dugin left the office. His aide in tow, he hurried to a car that would take him to Zhanyin, and then back here. And alone, with the door closed, he would place the call that would set events in motion that would change the world. Chapter 2. Saturday, 10:30 a.m., Moscow. Keith Fields Hutton burst into his room in the newly renovated Rasia Hotel, tossed his key on the dresser, and ran into the bathroom. On the way, he stooped and grabbed two curled pieces of fax paper that had fallen from the dresser-top machine he'd brought with him. This was the part of his job he hated the most. Not the danger, which was at times considerable. Not the protracted hours of sitting in airports, waiting for Aeroflot flights that never came, which was typical. And not the long weeks of being away from Peggy, which were most frustrating of all. What he hated most were all those goddamn cups of tea he had to drink. When he came to Moscow once a month, Fields Hutton always stayed at the Rossiya, just east of the Kremlin, and took long breakfasts in their elegant café. It gave him time to read the newspapers from front to back. More importantly, constantly draining his teacup gave Andrei, the waiter, a reason to come over with refills and 3, 4, or sometimes 5 fresh tea bags. Attached to the string of every bag was a label that bore the name Chashka Chai on the outside. Inside each tag was a circular spot of microfilm, which Fields Hutton pocketed when no one was looking. Most of the time, the maitre d' was looking, so Fields Hutton had to recover the film when other patrons came into the restaurant, distracting him. Andrei was one of Peggy's finds. His name came from a list of former soldiers, and she later learned that he had originally intended to make money working in a West Siberian oil settlement. But he was wounded in Afghanistan, and, after back surgery, he could no longer lift heavy gear. After Gorbachev, he could no longer afford to live. He was the perfect man to shuttle data between deeply buried operatives whose names he didn't know, whose faces he never saw, and Fields Hutton. If Andrei was ever caught, only Fields Hutton was at risk, and that came with the territory. Despite what many people outside the intelligence community believed, the KGB hadn't collapsed with the fall of communism. To the contrary, as the new Ministry of Security, it was more pervasive than ever. The agency had simply changed from an army of professionals into an even larger force of civilian freelancers. These operatives were paid for each solid lead they turned in. As a result, veterans and amateurs alike were looking everywhere for spies. Peggy called it a Russian version of Entertainment Tonight, with stringers everywhere. And she was right. The quarry was foreigners instead of celebrities, but the goal was the same, to report on furtive or suspicious activities. And because so many business people assumed there was no longer a threat, they stumbled into trouble by helping Russian associates exchange rubles for dollars or marks, by bringing in jewelry or expensive clothes for the black market, or by spying on rival foreign companies doing business here. Instead of being prosecuted, foreign prisoners were typically allowed to buy their way out of trouble. Fields Hutton joked that the ministry spent less time protecting national security than it did overseeing commerce. Japanese manufacturers alone paid Russian agents hundreds of millions of rubles a year to watch for competitors who might be keeping too close an eye on their activities in Russia. It was even rumored that the Japanese had put over 50 million rubles into the failed presidential bid of Interior Minister Nikolai Dyugin to help protect the country from an influx of foreign investors. The spy business was alive and well, and after 7 years, British agent Fields Hutton was still in the thick of it. Fields Hutton had graduated from Cambridge with an advanced degree in Russian literature and a desire to become a novelist. The Sunday after his graduation, he was sitting in a coffee house in Kensington, reading Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground, as it happened, when a woman in an adjoining booth turned around and asked, "How would you like to learn more about Russia?" She laughed, then said, "A great deal more." That was his introduction to British intelligence and to Peggy. Later, he learned that DI6 had a long association with Cambridge, going back to World War II and ULTRA, the top-secret project to decipher the legendary German Enigma code. Fields Hutton went for a walk with Peggy and agreed to a meeting with her superiors. Within a year, DI6 had set him up as a comic book publisher who was buying stories and art from Russian cartoonists for publication in Europe. That gave him a reason to make constant trips with large, well-stocked portfolios and stacks of magazines, as well as videocassettes and toys featuring characters the Russians had designed. From the start, Fields Hutton was amazed at how the gift of a superhero mug, or bath towel, or sweatshirt won him favors from airline employees, hotel workers, and even the police. Whether they turned around and sold the items on the black market or gave them to their kids, barter was a powerful tool in Russia. With all the magazines and toys he carried, it was easy to hide the microfilm, sometimes wrapped around the staple of a comic book, other times rolled inside a hollow claw on the hand of a Tiger Man action figure. Ironically, the comic book operation had taken on a life of its own, and British intelligence was actually collecting a handsome royalty from the licenses. The organization's charter prohibited money-making ventures.
"This is, after all, the government," Winston Churchill once told an agent who wanted to sell a code-breaking toy.
However, then-Prime Minister John Major and the Parliament agreed to let the comic book profits go to social programs to help the families of slain or disabled British operatives. Though he had come to love the comic book business, and decided he would become a novelist when he retired, with more than enough material for realistic thrillers, Fields Hutton's real job with British intelligence was to keep an eye on both foreign and domestic construction projects in eastern Russia. Secret rooms, hidden bugs, and sub-sub-basements were still being built, and when found and eavesdropped on, they provided a wealth of intelligence. His present contacts, Andrei and Leon, an illustrator who lived in an apartment in St. Petersburg, provided him with blueprints and on-site photographs of all the new buildings going up and renovations taking place on old ones within his territory. After leaving the bathroom, Fields Hutton sat on the edge of the bed, took the teabag tags from his pocket, and tore them open. Carefully, he removed each circular piece of microfilm and slipped them in turn into a high-powered magnifier, which, he told Customs, he brought to look at transparencies of paintings for cover art. "Yes, sir. I have many more Grim Ghost baseball caps than I need. Of course you can have one for your son. Why don't you take some for his friends as well?" What he saw in one of the photographs could be related to a small article he'd noticed in today's newspaper. The picture showed tarpaulins being rolled into a service elevator at the Hermitage. Pictures taken on successive days showed large crates of artwork being brought in as well. That shouldn't have aroused any suspicion. Construction was taking place throughout the museum to modernize and expand it in honor of the city's tricentenary in 2003. Moreover, the art museum was right on the Neva River. It was possible the walls were being lined with tarpaulin to protect the artwork from moisture. But Leon had faxed him two sheets, and according to the entirely symbolic Captain Legend comic strip on the first sheet, the superhero had flown to Hermes' world, that is, Leon had gone to the Hermitage, a week after the photos were taken. He reported that no construction using tarpaulin was taking place on any of the three floors in any of the three buildings. As for the crates, though artwork was always being loaned to the museum, no new pieces had gone on display, nor had any new exhibits been announced. With sections closed off for the modernization, exhibit space was at a premium. Fields Hutton would have DI-6 check to see if any museums or private collectors had shipped anything to the Hermitage recently, though he doubted they'd find anything. Then there were the hours of the workers who brought the tarpaulins and crates to the elevators. According to Leon's strip, the men, the Hera's world slaves who brought the weapons and food to a secret base, went downstairs in the morning and didn't come back until early in the evening. He'd been watching two in particular, who came there day after day, and whom he would follow if DI-6 thought it might help. Though they could very well be working on renovations, it was also possible they were simply using those to mask secret activity taking place underground. All of which dovetailed with the accident reported in this morning's newspaper and also described in Leon's second fax page. Yesterday, six museum employees heading home from work had skidded off the Kirovsky Prospect into the Neva River, where all of them drowned. Leon had gone to the crash site, and his rough cover sketch for Captain Legend told him more than the 2-inch article had reported. It showed the hero helping slaves from a rocket that had crash-landed in a pool of quicksand. The color notation for the smoke rising from the quicksand said, green. Chlorine. Were the men gassed? Was the truck that hit them off the bridge sent to do just that, to cover the fact that the men were murdered? The accident might be a coincidence, but intelligence work couldn't afford to overlook any possibility. The signs pointed to something unusual going on in St. Petersburg, and Fields Hutton wanted to find out what it was. Faxing Leon's artwork to his office in London, Fields Hutton included a note that ordered them to advance him £27, meaning they were to look at page 7 of today's Dienya, and that he was going to St. Petersburg to meet with the artist about this cover design. "I think we're on to something here," he wrote. "My feeling is if the writer can come up with a connection between the pool of quicksand and the underground mines of Hera's world, we'll have ourselves a fascinating storyline. I'll let you know what Leon thinks." After receiving an okay from London, Field Sutton packed his camera, slender vanity kit, Walkman, and artwork and toys into a shoulder bag, hurried to the lobby, and took a taxicab 2 miles to the northeast. At the St. Petersburg station, on Krasnoprudnaya, he bought his ticket for the 400-mile ride, then settled in on a hard bench to await the next train leaving for the ancient city on the Gulf of Finland. Chapter 3, Saturday, 12:20 p.m., Washington, D.C. During the Cold War, the nondescript two-story building located near the Naval Reserve flight line at Andrews Air Force Base was a ready room, a staging area for crack flight crews. In the event of a nuclear attack, it would have been their job to evacuate key officials from Washington, D.C. But the ivory-colored building was not an obsolete monument to the Cold War. The lawns were a little neater now, and there were gardens in the dirt patches where soldiers used to drill. Concrete flower pots had been erected on all sides to prevent anyone from getting too close with a car bomb, and the people who worked here didn't arrive in jeeps and Hughes Defenders, but in station wagons, Volvos, and the occasional Saab and BMW. The 78 full-time employees who worked here now were employed by the National Crisis Management Center. They were hand-picked tacticians, generals, diplomats, intelligence analysts, computer specialists, psychologists, reconnaissance experts, environmentalists, attorneys, and even media manipulators, or spin doctors. The NCMC shared another 42 support personnel with the Department of Defense and the CIA, and commanded a 12-person tactical strike team known as Stryker, which was based at the nearby Quantico FBI Academy. The charter of the NCMC was unlike any other in the history of the United States. Over a 2-year period, the group had spent more than $100 million on equipment and high-tech modifications, turning the former ready room into an operations center designed to interface with the Central Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, White House, State Department, Department of Defense, Defense Intelligence Agency, National Reconnaissance Office, and Intelligence and Threat Analysis Center. But after a shakedown period of 6 months, in which they handled both domestic and international crises, Op Center, as it was familiarly called, now had parity with those agencies, and then some. Director Paul Hood reported to President Michael Lawrence himself, and what had started as an informational clearinghouse with SWAT capabilities now had the singular capacity to monitor, initiate, and manage operations worldwide. They were a unique mix of old professionals who took a methodical, hands-on, agents-in-the-field approach to intelligence, and fair-haired boys who reveled in high-tech and bold strokes. On top of the patchwork tapestry was Paul Hood. Though Hood was not quite a saint, his selflessness had caused his jaded co-workers to dub him Pope Paul. He was scrupulously honest, despite having been a hotshot banker during the Reagan terms. He was also exceedingly low-key, even though he'd served as the mayor of Los Angeles for 2 years. Hood was constantly schooling his team in the new art of crisis management. He saw this as an alternative to the traditional Washingtonian responses that leaned toward inactivity or all-out war. In Los Angeles, he had pioneered the art of slicing problems into manageable segments and handing each to professionals who worked closely with one another. It had worked effectively in Los Angeles, and it was also working here, though it went against the prevailing I'm-in-charge-here mindset of Washington. His number two man, Mike Rogers, once told him that they'd probably find more adversaries in the nation's capital than anywhere else in the world, since bureau chiefs, agency directors, and elected officials would view Op Center's management style as a threat to their fiefdoms, and many of them wouldn't stop at trying to undermine Op Center's effectiveness. "Washingtonians are like zombies," Rogers had said, "able to rise from the politically dead as times and moods change. Look at Nixon, at Jimmy Carter. As a result, rivals don't just try to destroy careers, they try to ruin lives. And if that's not enough, they turn on families and friends as well." But Hood didn't care. Their charter was to look after the security of the United States, not to advance the reputation of Op Center or its employees, and he took that mission very seriously indeed. He also believed that if they did the job they were supposed to do, their rivals couldn't lay a glove on them. At the moment, Anne Ferris didn't see the hotshot or the politician or the Pope sitting in the director's chair. Her dark rust eyes saw the awkward young boy and the man. Despite the strong jaw, wavy black hair, and steely dark hazel eyes, Hood looked like a kid who wished he could stay here in Washington and play with his friends and spy satellites and field operatives rather than go on vacation with his family. If the kids didn't miss their old friends, and the Move East hadn't put such a strain on his marriage, and knew that Paul wouldn't be going. The 43-year-old director of Op Center was sitting in his large office at the high-security facility. Deputy Director General Mike Rogers was seated in an armchair to the left of the desk, and Press Officer Ferris was sitting on the sofa to the right. Hood's itinerary for his trip to Southern California was on the computer. "Sharon rests a week off from her boss, Andy McDonald, who says his cable show can't live without her cooking healthy segment," Hood said. "And we end up at bloopers, the antithesis of healthy eating. Anyway, that's where we'll be the first night. The kids saw it on MTV, and if you page me there, I probably won't hear it." Anne leaned forward and patted the back of his hand, her dazzling white smile even brighter than the yellow designer kerchief she wore in her long brown hair. "I bet if you let your hair down, you'll have a blast," she said. "I read about bloopers in Spin. Order a pickle dog or French fried pie. You'll love them." Hood snickered. "How about putting that on our agency seal? Op Center, making the world safe for pickle-flavored hot dogs." "I'll have to ask Lowell what that would be in Latin," Anne smiled. "We'd want it to at least sound lofty." Rogers sighed, and both Hood and Anne glanced over. The two-star general was sitting with his leg across a knee, shaking it briskly. "Sorry, Mike," Hood said. "I'm letting my hair down a little too early."
"It's not that," Rogers said. "You're just not talking my language."
As a press director, Anne was accustomed to listening for the truth behind soft-pedaled words. She detected both criticism and envy in Rogers' voice.
"It's not my language either," Hood admitted. "But one thing you learn with kids, and Anne will back me up, is that you've got to adapt. Hell, I find myself wanting to say the same things about rap music and heavy metal that my parents said about the Young Rascals. You've got to roll with these things."
Roger's expression was dubious.
"Do you know what George Bernard Shaw said about adaptation?"
"Can't say that I do," Hood admitted.
"He said the reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. I don't like rap and never will. More than that, I won't ever pretend to."
Hood said, "What do you do when Lieutenant Colonel Squires listens to it?"
Rogers said, "I order him to shut it off. He tells me I'm being unreasonable."
"And you quote Shaw," Anne said. Rogers looked at her and nodded. Hood raised his eyes.
"Interesting. Well, let's see if we can all agree on what has to be done over the next few days anyway. First, my schedule."
Hood shucked his boyish smile and was all business as he looked back at the computer screen. Anne tried to wink a smile out of the deputy director, but didn't get it. The truth was he rarely smiled, and only seemed genuinely happy when he'd been out hunting boar, totalitarians, or anyone who put their careers before the safety of fighting men and women. "I'll be doing the Magna Studio Tour on Monday," Hood continued, "and Wallace World Amusement Park on Tuesday. The kids want to surf, so Wednesday's a beach day, and so on. If you need me, I'll have the cellular with me. It won't be a problem getting to the nearest police station or FBI office in case you need me on a secure line in a hurry."
"It should be a quiet week," Anne said.
She had dumped Intelligence Officer Bob Herbert's morning update into her power book before coming to the meeting, and now she flipped up the lid.
"The borders in Eastern Europe and the Middle East are relatively cool. The CIA was able to help Mexican authorities close down the rebel base in Jalapa without incident. Things are calm in Asia after the near war in Korea, and the Ukrainians and Russians are at least talking again about who owns what in the Crimea."
"Mike,
Will the outcome of the Russian elections affect that? Hood asked.
We don't think so, Rogers said. The new Russian president, Kirill Zhanyin, has crossed swords with Ukrainian leader Vesnik in the past, but Zhanyin's a pro. He'll extend an olive branch. In any case, our projection is for no code reds during the coming week.
Hood nodded, and knew he put little faith in what he called the three Ps, projections, polls, and psychobabble. But at least he was pretending to listen to them now. When he first came to Op Center, Paul and staff psychologist Liz Gordon got along like Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan.
I hope you're right, Hood said, but if Op Center is called in on anything over a code blue, I want to be the one who signs off on our activities.
Roger's leg stopped moving. The light brown eyes that usually seemed golden appeared dark.
I can handle it, Paul.
Never said you couldn't. You showed everyone what you could do when you stopped those missiles in North Korea.
So what's the problem?
None, said Hood. This isn't about ability, Mike. It's about accountability.
I understand, Rogers insisted in his courtly way. But the regulations allow for this. The deputy director is allowed to okay operations when the director is away.
The word is indisposed, not away, Hood pointed out. I won't be indisposed, and you know how Congress gets about foreign adventures. If anything goes wrong, I'm the one who'll be hauled in front of a Senate committee and asked to explain why. I want to be able to tell them because I was there, not because I read about it in your report. Roger's high-ridged nose, broken four times in college basketball, dropped slightly.
I understand.
But you still don't agree, said Hood.
No. Frankly, I'd welcome the chance to take on Congress. I'd give those seat warmers a lesson in government by action, not consensus.
Hood said, That's why I'd like to be the one to handle them, Mike. They still pay the bills around here.
Which is the reason men like Ollie North do what they do, Rogers said, to get around all the deputy director's coordinating committees. The milksops who take proposals under advisement and sit on them for months and finally give them back too diluted and too late to matter worth a damn.
Hood looked like he wanted to say something, and Rogers looked like he wanted to hear it and lob it right back. Instead, both men regarded each other in silence.
Well, Anne said jauntily, that gives us control over those tense single hostage code greens and multiple domestic hostage blues, and puts the easy overseas hostage yellows and state of war reds on your shoulders.
She closed the lid of her power book, looked at her watch, and rose.
Paul, you'll send your schedule to our computers?
Hood looked at the computer. He touched Alt F6 on his keyboard, and then hit PB Enter and MR Enter.
Done, he said. Great. Will you try to have a wonderful and relaxing trip?
Hood nodded. Then he regarded Rogers again.
Thanks for your help, he said, rising and shaking Rogers' hand across the desk. If I knew how to make this better for you, Mike, I would.
See you in a week, Rogers said, then turned and walked past Anne.
I'll see you too,
Anne said to Hood, giving him a little goodbye wave and an encouraging smile.
Don't forget to write. And relax.
I'll send you a postcard from Bloopers, he said. Anne shut the door and followed Rogers down the hall. She elbowed around co-workers and hurried past the open office doors and the closed doors of OpCenter's intelligence-gathering departments.
Are you all right?
She asked when she fell in beside him. Rogers nodded.
You don't look all right.
I still can't strike the right note with him.
I know, Anne said. Sometimes you think he's really got a handle on some kind of larger world view. The rest of the time you feel like he's trying to keep you in line like a smarty-pants school monitor.
Rogers looked at her. That's a fair assessment, Anne. You've obviously given this, him, a lot of thought.
She flushed. I tend to reduce everybody to sound bites. It's a bad habit.
To change the course of the conversation, Anne made a point of emphasizing the everybody. She knew at once that that had been a mistake.
What's my sound bite? Rogers asked.
Anne looked at him squarely.
You're a frank, decisive man in a world that has grown too complex for those qualities.
They stopped beside his office.
And is that good or bad? He asked.
It's troublesome, Anne replied. With a little bit of give, you could probably get a lot more.
Without taking his eyes off Anne, Rogers entered his code in the keypad on the jam.
But if something isn't what you want, is it worth having? He asked.
I've always felt that half is better than none, she replied.
I see. I just don't agree.
Rogers smiled now.
And Anne?
Next time, if you mean to say I'm stubborn, just come out and say it. Rogers flipped her a little salute, walked into his office, and shut the door behind him. Anne stood there for a moment before turning and walking slowly toward her office. She felt bad for Mike. He was a good man and a bright one. But he was fatally flawed by his desire for action over diplomacy, even when that action disregarded little things like national sovereignty and congressional approval. It was his reputation as a fire-eater that had caused him to be passed over as Assistant Secretary of Defense, landing him here as a consolation prize. He accepted the post because he was first and foremost a good soldier, but he was never happy about it, or about reporting to a non-military superior. But then, she thought, everyone's got problems of some kind. Like her, for example. The problem to which Rogers had indiscreetly alluded. She was going to miss Paul, her good and honorable cavalier, the knight who wouldn't leave his wife however much she took him for granted. Worse than that, Anne couldn't help but fantasize about how she would make Paul relax if it were she and her son going with him to Southern California, instead of Sharon and the kids. Chapter 4. Saturday, 2 p.m., Brighton Beach. Since being smuggled in from Russia to America in 1989, handsome, dark-haired Herman Yosef had worked at the Bistonia Bagel Shop in the Brighton Beach section of Brooklyn. Here he was responsible for covering the still-warm dough with salt, sesame seeds, garlic, onions, poppy seeds, and various combinations thereof. Working near the ovens was miserable in the summer, delightful in the winter, and pleasantly unchallenging throughout the year. Most of the time, working here was nothing like working in Moscow. Owner Arnold Belnick buzzed him on the intercom.
"Herman, come to the office," he said. "I have a special order."
Whenever he heard that, the slender 37-year-old Muscovite was no longer unchallenged. Old instincts and feelings came to life. The need to survive, to succeed, to serve his country. They were skills honed in 10 years of working for the KGB before it was transformed. Throwing his apron on the counter and turning the bagel finishing process over to Belnick's young son, Herman ran up the groaning old stairs 2 at a time. He walked right into the office, which was lit by a fluorescent desk lamp and the light coming through a dirty skylight. He shut the door, locked it, and then stood beside the old man at the desk. Belnick looked back at him through a cloud of cigarette smoke.
"Here,"
he said, handing Herman a paper. Herman looked at it, then gave the paper back to Belnick. The round, balding man put it in the ashtray, touched the glowing tip of his cigarette to it, and set the note afire. Then he dumped the ashes on the floor and ground them to powder.
"Any questions?"
"Yes. Will I be going to the safe house?"
"No,"
said Belnick.
"Even if you're being watched, there's no reason anyone should connect you with the event."
Herman nodded. He had been to the place on Forest Road in Valley Stream before, after killing a Chechenian rebel who had come to raise funds for the secession. It was a safe house operated by the Russian mafia for its operatives. From there, it was just a 15-minute ride to JFK International Airport, or a 20-minute ride to Jamaica Bay. Either way, it was easy enough to get operatives out of the country if things got too hot. Otherwise, when the trail got cold, he could return to Brighton Beach and the Bistonia. Herman went to a locker in a corner of the room, removed the false back, and reached in. And as casually as if he were gathering salt or poppy seeds, he began removing the things he'd need. Chapter 5. Sunday, 12 p.m., St. Petersburg. His trusty old Bullsey 35mm camera slung around his neck, Keith Fields Hutton purchased a ticket in a kiosk outside the Hermitage near the Neva, then walked the short distance to the sprawling Gold Dome Museum. As always, he felt humbled as he walked through the white marble columns on the ground floor. He experienced that every time he entered one of the most historic buildings in the world. The State Hermitage Museum is the largest museum in Russia. It was established in 1764 by Catherine the Great as a separate area of the 2-year-old Winter Palace. It quickly grew from the 225 pieces of art she bought for it to the current collection of 3 million pieces. The museum houses works by Leonardo da Vinci, Van Gogh, Rembrandt, El Greco, Monet, and countless masters, as well as ancient artifacts from the Paleolithic, Mesolithic, Neolithic, Bronze, and Iron Ages. Today, the museum consists of 3 buildings side by side: the Winter Palace, the Little Hermitage, located directly to the northeast, and the Large Hermitage, situated northeast of that. Until 1917, the Hermitage was closed to all but the royal family, their friends, and aristocrats. Only after the Revolution was it opened to the public. As Fields Hutton entered the great main hall with its ticket-takers and souvenir stands, he considered how sad it was that he was here. When Catherine established the museum, she'd posted some very sensible rules of conduct for her guests. The first and most important was Article 1. On entering, the title and rank must be put off, as well as the hat and sword. She was right. The experience of art should ease personal and political squabbles, not conceal them. But both Fields Hutton and Leon believed the Russians had broken that compact. In addition to the death of the 6 workers and the shipments of material, there were increased levels of microwave radiation. Leon had come over before his employer's arrival and used a cellular phone in different areas around the museum. The closer he got to the river, the more the reception broke up. That might explain the tarpaulins. If the Russians had established some kind of communications center here, below the waterline, the electronic components would have to be insulated from the moisture. The fact that they might have set up a communications center in the museum made strategic sense. Art was as negotiable as gold, and museums were rarely bombed in wartime. Only Hitler had violated the sanctity of this museum by bombing it. However, the citizens of what was then Leningrad had taken the precaution of evacuating their treasures to Sverdlovsk in the Urals. Did the Russians build a center here because they were anticipating a war? Fields Hutton wondered. Fields Hutton consulted the layout of the museum in his blue guide. He had memorized it on the train, but didn't want to arouse the suspicion of guards by appearing to know where he needed to go. Each guard was a potential Ministry of Security freelancer. After glancing at the map, Fields Hutton turned to the left, to the long, columned Rastrelli Gallery. Every inch of floor space was exposed, leaving no place to hide a secret room above ground or a hidden staircase that could lead underground. Strolling around the wall that separated the Rastrelli Gallery from the east wing, he stopped when he spotted what had once apparently been a custodial closet. There was a keypad beside the door, and he smiled when he read the printed sign on an easel to the left. It said, in Cyrillic letters, "This is the future home of Arts for Children, a television service that will broadcast the treasures of the Hermitage to students in schools throughout the nation." Maybe, thought Fields Hutton, and maybe not. Pretending to read his blue guide while he watched the guard, Fields Hutton waited until the man turned away, then hurried over to the door. There was a security camera above it, so he made sure not to look up from his book or show his face. He pretended to sneeze, covering his face with his hand and stealing a look at the lens. It was short, under 20 millimeters. It had to be a wide-angle lens, covering the door as well as the area well to the left and to the right, but not on the bottom. Fields Hutton reached into his pants pocket and removed his handkerchief. Inside was a Mexican peso, one of the few coins which had no value in Russia. At worst, if it were found, it would be picked up and kept as a souvenir, hopefully by a high-ranking official who had something useful to say in private. Sneezing again and bending hard as he did, Fields Hutton slid the peso under the door. He was relatively certain that there would be a motion detector on the other side of the door, but that it wouldn't be sensitive enough to notice the coin. Otherwise, every cockroach and mouse in the museum would set it off. Rising quickly, he walked away, his nose buried in the handkerchief. Meandering back toward the main entrance, he allowed a guard to search his shoulder bag, and then went outside, found a spot under a tree by the river, and slipped his CD Walkman from the bag. He jumped the machine to different tracks on the disc, the numbers describing, in code, just what he'd seen in the museum. These numbers were recorded on the writable disk. Later, when he was away from any receivers that might be based in the museum, he would order the Walkman to transmit the signal to the British consulate in Helsinki, where it would be relayed to London. When he finished telling them about the TV studio, Fields Hutton sat back to listen to what he hoped were the sounds of espionage taking place around his small peso. Chapter 6, Sunday, 12:50 p.m., St. Petersburg. When the coin slid under the door of the reception area, it passed through an electromagnetic CIS. The counter-impulse screen was designed to be disrupted by any signal that passed beneath it, down to the cadmium batteries that powered digital watches. The disruption sounded a beep that overrode other information coming into the earphones of Operations Center Security Director Glinka. Though he wasn't an alarmist, Colonel Roski was, especially with 0 hour, a little over a day away, and a rumor that someone from the outside had been watching what was going on for the past few days. He checked with the receptionist, who said that no one had come or gone. Thanking her, the short, muscular man slid his headset off, handed it to his aide, got up from his seat, and walked down the narrow corridor to the colonel's cubicle. He looked for any excuse to stretch his legs, having spent 9 hours doing nothing but test open bugs in dozens of embassies around the world. This, after having spent 4 hours of running two of the operations center phone lines, through a battery of tests for on- and off-hook voltages, online listen, tone sweep, high-voltage pulse test, and all-wire listen tests. The central hallway was about the length and width of two bus aisles, strung end-to-end. It was lit by 3 25-watt bulbs set in black fixtures and suspended from the ceiling. It was so thoroughly soundproof that nothing less than a cannon or jackhammer could be heard or felt by someone on the outside. Both interior and exterior walls were made of brick covered with a liquid foam coating, and 6 alternating layers of spun fiberglass and inch-thick sheets of hard black rubber. These were topped with tarpaulin to insulate the facility from moisture, and then by a layer of pasteboard. A coat of matte black paint absorbed the light which might otherwise leak through cracks in the floors above them. Like a tree trunk, the corridor had several branches, each leading to several areas. Computers, audio surveillance, aerial reconnaissance, communications, library, exit, and more. General Orloff's office was on one end, and Colonel Roski's on the other. Glinka reached the colonel's office and pressed the red button on the speaker beside the door.
"Yes?"
the high voice crackled through the speaker.
"Colonel, it's Glinka. I've picked up a 0.98-second disturbance in the reception area. That isn't long enough for someone to have walked through, but you wanted me to tell you if there were any—" "Where's the janitor?"
Glinka said.
"He is working in the Kurgan wings." "Thank you,"
Roski said.
"I'll look into it myself." "Sir, I can go and—" "That will be all," Roski snapped.
Glinka ran a hand across his blunt crew cut.
"Yes, sir,"
he said, as he turned from the door and headed back to his post. So much for a short walk up the stairs, he thought. But it was better to be miserable than to cross the unforgiving Colonel Roski, which is what poor Pavel Odinya had done when he stole equipment from the facility. Glinka had only mentioned the theft to the colonel because he didn't want to be blamed for it himself. He never thought the computer software designer would meet with such a horrible fate, which everyone here knew that Roski had orchestrated. Shambling back to his seat, he retrieved his earphones and settled in for what he was sure would be another unbroken shift of 5 hours or more. He quietly considered all the ways he would love to derail the strutting son of a bitch, if he had the courage. Tucked into his old crisply pressed black uniform, with its distinctive red lapel flashes and freshly blocked hat, short, lean Colonel Leonid Roski left his office and strode toward the fireproof door that led to the staircase. Like all soldiers of the Spetsnaz, a word formed from specialnye, nazhnichenye, special purpose, he had both nerves and character of granite. It showed in his hard expression. His dark eyebrows dipped severely above his long, straight nose, and his thin lips turned down at the edges where they blended with the deep, hard lines from his nose. He wore a thick mustache, which was unusual for the breed, but his gait was typical of the special forces, fast and assured, as though only an invisible leash kept him from racing toward a goal only he could see. Opening the door and shutting it firmly behind him, Ruski pressed the keypad code to lock it, then hit a button on the intercom beside it.
Raisa, lock the outside door.
Yes, sir, she said.
Then he hurried along a dark corridor, up another flight of stairs, and through another keypad-controlled door to a TV studio. Ordinarily, he would have changed into civilian clothes before coming out here, but there wasn't time. Workers in the studio were setting up permanent lights, monitors, and TV cameras. They ignored Ruski as he made his way through the cables, crates, and equipment. Beyond the glass-enclosed control booth was a steep, brightly lit stairwell. Ruski climbed and entered a small reception area at the top. Raisa rose from her desk and greeted him with a nod. She went to say something, but he put a finger to his lips to silence her and looked around. Ruski saw the peso at once, lying innocuously under the receptionist's desk on the right side of the room. The two employees who were unpacking equipment stopped to look at him. He motioned them to keep talking. They continued discussing a soccer match as Ruski studied the coin. He circled it like a snake girdling its prey, never touching it and afraid to breathe on it. A glitch might have triggered the alarm in Glinka's headset, and the peso might be exactly what it seemed to be. But he hadn't survived 20 years in the Special Forces by taking anything for granted. He saw that the peso was well worn, as though it had been in circulation for years. The 1982 date seemed appropriate to its condition. He looked at the sides of the coin, at the faded ridges, at the dirt wedged between them. It all seemed very authentic. But the eye could be fooled. Pulling a long black hair from the back of his head, he held it near the coin. The hair dipped like a divining rod. Touching his index finger to the tip of his tongue, he gently dabbed the top of the coin with saliva. He looked closely at his finger and saw traces of dust. Where he'd touched the coin, it was clean. Static electricity had attracted both dust and the hair, which meant that something inside the coin was generating an electrostatic field. His lips tight with anger, Ruski stood and returned to the operations center. The transmitter in the peso wasn't very powerful. Whoever was listening through it had to be within a few hundred yards of the museum. The security cameras would tell Ruski who that might be, and then the spy would be dealt with. Chapter 7. Sunday, 9 a.m., Washington, D.C. Mike Rogers passed buoyantly through the keypad entry on the ground floor of Op Center. After greeting the armed guards seated behind the Lexan, who provided him with the day's password, Rogers hurried through the first floor administrative level, where the top officials had offices in the old evacuation team headquarters. Like Paul Hood, Rogers preferred to be downstairs, in the new underground area, where the real business of Op Center was conducted. Another armed guard was stationed by the elevator, and after giving her the password, Rogers was admitted to the elevator. The anachronistic and less expensive who-goes-there sentry system had been chosen for Op Center instead of the more elaborate high-tech systems used at the other agencies, where fingerprint IDs had been compromised by computer-printed, laser-etched gloves, and voice identification systems had been fooled by synthesizers. Though Rogers had seen the guard nearly every day for 6 months, and knew the names of her husband and children, he wouldn't have been admitted if he didn't have the password. If he'd tried to enter, he would have been arrested. If he resisted, he might have been shot. In Op Center, precision, competency, and patriotism came before friendship. Emerging in the heart of Op Center, called the bullpen, Rogers made his way through a maze of cubicles to the action offices ringing the hub. Unlike the offices above, the rooms here could tap into intelligence resources that ranged from satellite imagery to communicating directly with operatives around the world to accessing computers and databases that could accurately predict the rice harvest in Rangoon 5 years hence. Rogers was using Hood's office while the chief was away. The office was situated next to the conference room, affectionately known as the tank. The tank was surrounded by a wall of electromagnetic waves that prevented electronic surveillance. Rumor had it that the microwaves could also cause sterility and insanity. Staff psychologist Liz Gordon half-jokingly said that the waves explained a lot of the behavior that took place within these walls. Alert and energized, despite a late Saturday night in the town, Rogers entered the code on the keypad beside Hood's office door. The door popped open, the lights came on, and for the first time in 6 months, Rogers smiled with contentment. At last he was in charge of OpCenter. Even so, he knew he wasn't being entirely fair to Hood. He had his den-mother's side, as Anne had said, but the director was a good man. He was well-intentioned, and more important, he was a highly capable manager. And it was efficient to delegate authority internally to a group of relatively autonomous experts, like Martha McCall and Lowell Coffey II, Matt Stoll and Anne Ferris. But more and more, Rogers felt that OpCenter needed to be run by one man's will, like Hoover's FBI. It had to be run by someone who didn't consult with the CIA or the National Security Council before acting, but let other organizations know what he was doing after the fact. After defusing a war in Korea and the potential bombing of Japan, he had come to believe that OpCenter needed to be more aggressive on the world stage, rather than reactive. Which is one reason it can't continue being anonymous, Rogers thought. But there was time enough to do something about that. Something passive, like leaking information to the press, or something dramatic, like sending Stryker on the kinds of missions that had made Israeli commandos so feared and respected. Missions that didn't have to be attributed to others' operatives, the way their recent attack on the missile site in North Korea was attributed to the South Koreans. Rogers and Hood had had this discussion many times, and the director invariably pointed to their charter, which forbade adventurism. They were supposed to act like police, he said, not fifth columnists. But to Rogers, a charter was like sheet music. You could play the notes as written and follow the composer's instructions, yet there was still a great deal of latitude for interpretation. In Vietnam, he'd read and reread Edward Gibbon's The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and something the author had written became Rogers' credo, that the first of earthly blessings is independence. Fired up by Gibbons and by a dog-eared copy of George Patton's War as I Knew It that his father had given him, Rogers served two tours of duty.